Hello, and welcome to this slightly belated Thanksgiving edition of the Crossbox Podcast. Thanksgiving, at least, if you're over here in America with us.
Yep.
I'm your host, Jay, with I'm your co-host, John.
With his co-host, Jay, that being me, and
yep.
The other guy talking being John.
Of course, I'm John, he's Jay. This isn't the April Fool's Podcast yet, though that's a funny idea that we'll have to save for later.
And I was like, I was getting all geared up to like end his co-host, John?
Wait a minute.
That's not me.
No, it isn't. No, so now that we know who we are, let's be positive. We know who we are. Positivity item number one.
Yeah. Well, that falls to me. And it is that time of year where my wife and I have decided it's about time to start our real estate search. We like the Pittsburgh area. I grew up here. We're likely going to stay here for, the foreseeable future, and that sounds like it's time to start putting down roots. So, the thing that I'm positive about today is the Pittsburgh real estate market. I mean, all you people on the coast, you guys are suckers. I mean, I can buy, a pretty nice house, a lot of room for, less than $250,000, and in New York, that buys you a broom closet, and in San Francisco, that is, you're basically, you are homeless with $250,000.
Right, that does not buy you a box under a bridge. So
maybe a tent, and then to pay all the fines that the rich liberals use to try and keep you out of their fancy design city that nobody can afford to live in except for them.
Yep, it's pretty terrible. I'm super positive today about the CFD comp. This was designed by Jared out in Seattle. Jared, you rock, who has a little company, Binary Engineering, and he plays around with some awesome CNC work. He used some computational fluid dynamics, CFD, to design a compensator for, pistols for USPSA open class shooting, which I am very fond of. And he did, again, he's using math, and I love computational fluid dynamics. I think it's really cool. I think it's fun, which makes me one of eight people on the planet to actually say that.
Yeah, math is cool.
Yep. And I really like that he put a lot of work into modeling the flow to see kind of what the gas pressure wanted to perform best. And he also did a whole bunch of graphs that he publishes on his website, so you can see how the compensator performs with barrel ports, different numbers and different sizes. Barrel porting, of course, you're kind of trading off compensator pull versus muzzle flip, so how much recoil control, recoil counteracting versus how much muzzle rise do you want to fight. But it's a really cool website. Link will be added in the description. And he does runs kind of when he gets enough interest. But when he did a run, he was super nice and emailed me and said, hey, they're up, because they sold out in 3 hours.
Yeah. I do want to point out that this particular compensator is of a very cool design if you are, like me, something of a old-timey propulsion nerd.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go on Wikipedia and look at diagrams of multiple expansion steam engines, you'll see a pattern. The first cylinder is small because you've got high-pressure gas acting on it. The second cylinder is larger, and if the third cylinder, if present, is even larger than that, because you're working with lower pressure gas, you need more of it for a given amount of impulse. Right. So John's holding it up for me to see. The first hole is narrow, maybe less than the width of my pinky. The next one's maybe a little bit bigger than that, and the third one's this big honking hole to let all of that remaining gas out.
Yep.
And
it's a three chamber design. The chambers get bigger as you get further from the muzzle.
And it's really cool because that's kind of something that we've established works based on history, something that we knew as humans, just never thought to apply to firearms design until now. And I think it's really cool that the computational modeling bore out what we knew to be the case kind of by steam engine designers way back in the day.
It's also made entirely out of titanium, which is super light and also plus 10 coolness points because titanium is awesome.
I will say that most steam engines, of which I'm aware, are not made of titanium.
No, they're decidedly less cooler than that.
Certainly the reciprocating steam engines, which I know. It's not really a common thing.
Yeah, they don't get bonus coolness points from titanium. And that brings us to the news.
It does bring us to the news.
All right. I think I'll start off here.
Yeah, I guess I can count them down. I suppose I forgot to play the news theme, but here, I'll do that now. It's time for the news. Anyway,
all right.
So, John's got the first topic, and I will let him demo that as soon as I arrange my things correctly and get things set up. Okay, ready? In 3, 2, 1.
So the United States Department of Defense Special Operations Command, also known as SOCOM, has officially approved and type-classed the Glock 19 MOS with the Leupold Delta Point as their pistol of choice. SOCOM's a huge fan of Glock pistols, and they've actually picked the Delta Point in particular because it is a really nice little red dot that is reliable, and you can change the battery without removing the red dot. Pretty awesome. And the Glock 19 because Glock 19s are awesome. They're amazing. SOCOM loves their Glock 19s. What's cool here is that, you know, slide-mounted red dots, a lot of us civilian gun nerds really like them. They're a great way to... They're just the way of the future, and they're a much better sighting system, and it's really cool to see SOCOM kind of catching up with something that we in the civilian world have really been coming around to and embracing. If you'd like to know more, we've got a ton of articles in the archives about red dots on pistols, plus further discussion of SOCOM.
All right.
So there we go. All right. Now, Jay, you have a news item that is quite a bit more somber and less happy.
Yes, I will be foregoing the countdown theme for this. So I suppose I'll just start off. What I'm going to talk about today is the search for the lost Argentine submarine ARA San Juan. And I don't use the word lost lightly. It seems like that's the most likely scenario now. Lost about a week ago. Kind of went out of contact about a week ago and was supposed to show up at a naval base over the weekend if it were just a communications failure. But the now released final communication from the submarine claims that that they were experiencing leaks through the snorkel and water in the battery compartments, and water in battery compartments makes hydrogen, and hydrogen in diesels make explosions. And it was also reported that an underwater listening post, for detecting underwater earthquakes, heard a sound kind of like a submarine imploding. And so all evidence appears that the 44 brave sailors on the San Juan are lost, and we wish their families the best, and we'll take a moment of silence to commemorate the lost submariners. Go with God, men.
Yep.
And it's a hard life, the one where you're underwater.
It really is. And this is, I thought one of the things, of course, that you can see with this disaster and many others is that brotherhood of sailors. When the submarine was reported overdue formally by the Argentinians, a U.S. Navy submarine, naval reconnaissance aircraft went down to the South Pacific. The South Atlantic to look for the sub. And also... One of the other ships that went down was a Royal Navy deep sea rescue vehicle. So despite any hostilities, tensions between the Argentinians and the British, there's something about if you're a submariner missing, you got to go find that guy.
Yeah. Well, just sailors in peril generally.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's exactly. A brotherhood among the nations, even nations at war. They're at loggerheads, I suppose.
Yeah. The relationships aren't great, but. There you have it, folks.
Yep.
Shades of the Thresher.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. All right. Well, on to our three topics of discussion.
We're going to begin with a slightly more theoretical, less dire defense topic.
Right. Yes. That's right. And we're going to do a couple of these slightly differently. So our first topic is going to talk about tank engines. And of course, if you know us, I'm a giant tank nerd.
And, the nerdiest.
Right. Just like super tank nerd of... Yeah.
Like, I don't know if I know any bigger tank nerds. And I read a lot of defense blogs. I don't read, like, specialist tank nerd blogs, but...
Yeah, there's... I'm definitely closing in on some of the serious geeks on the internet, I'd like to think. Certainly random knowledge is up there. But we're going to talk about tank engines. We're going to do this in kind of an interview-ish format. And then, don't worry, folks, Jay will get his turn with rocket engines in a moment.
Pretty excited about that one.
Yep. He's our rocket man.
So go ahead and introduce your topic, John.
Certainly. So recently, the U.S. Army has been looking again at re-engineering the M1 Abrams.
Yeah.
And of course, the M1 Abrams, back in the 70s when it was being developed, had a choice of two engines, and one of which was a really, really exotic variable compression ratio diesel, and one of which was a... gas turbine engine. They ended up going with the gas turbine engine. And that's provided generally good service.
I think I want to interject briefly to say that it's a really funny state of affairs when the vehicle gas turbine is the less exotic option.
Right. Yeah, this had, like, the pistons could actually be changed dimensionally.
Huh.
You could, and there will be pictures eventually when I get around to writing about the engine. But you could, like, increase or decrease basically the height of the piston to change the compression ratio of the diesel while it was operating. Yeah.
That doesn't seem fiddly at all.
No. It didn't really work that well.
What, a system like that?
Yeah. So, now the gas turbine has excellent torque and really a favorable torque curve, not just peak torque. It gives you torque early. It can run on any flammable, reasonably viscous fluid will provide power, and it doesn't care. Mm-hmm. And there's minimal loss of power.
Is that reasonably viscous or reasonably, like, free-flowing?
You need an amount of flow for the pumps. Right. I'm not super familiar with the pumps on Abrams to know what the viscosity limitations are. But if it burns and it can get through the pumps, the engine will run it.
So not bunker oil, but maybe like coal slurry.
Right.
Yeah.
And certainly in a wartime situation, if you came to a civilian gasoline station, you could fill the tanks with gasoline and you wouldn't have a problem.
That's useful.
Right. Especially in a Cold War scenario where you're looking at kind of a defensive Germany-Poland kind of fight.
A lot of gas stations in Germany.
Right. It simplifies logistics quite a bit. One other nice thing about gas turbine engines, which bears mentioning, because this will come up again later with some of the alternatives, they don't care about the cold.
Yes.
Gas turbines start very easily in the cold, and the Russians noticed this as well with the gas turbines on the T-80.
That as long as your fuel is not... diesel has the trouble that it gels in cold weather.
Right. So as long as it doesn't, like, solidify, again, as long as the pumps can keep it flowing, mm-hmm. the gas turbine will start much more easily than a conventional diesel will.
Does the Abrams have, a fuel tank heater?
No.
Interesting.
Don't believe it does. Well, I'd have to look again in my, like, tables.
I think the usual American fuel is Jet A, right? Yeah.
Correct.
And that doesn't have the, like, diesel's gelatinizing problems. So
right.
It's not a common problem. It's just that, we drove a lot of lot of old Mercedes back in the day.
Yeah, and you'd have to keep the...
Well, they had a little heating element, like, around the fuel lines and around the pickup in the tank, so you could...
Yeah. You'd
have liquid, like you just leave the key on while the glow plugs are running, and it'll liquefy some fuel for you, too.
Yeah, exactly. See? It beats lighting a fire under your tank, right? Now, the one problem, of course, with the gas turbine engine is it is thirsty, and the reason for the thirstiness is that, jet engines have throttle lag, gas turbines have a throttle lag, and to fix this problem and give you acceleration when you need it, you idle. Well, quote-unquote idle, at a very high RPM, it's like 50 to 66% full revs is your tack idle setting, which is what everybody uses. So if you're as long as the tank is moving, it's not terrible. It uses a little more fuel than the diesel. But when you start talking about idling and waiting, you really start to pay the price.
And there's a lot of that in tank warfare, unfortunately.
Right. The other thing, of course, is that the AGT 1500s are kind of old. And so the U.S. Army is looking at replacing them with something else. And they do have a plan, but first let's talk what the possible options are.
Well, I've heard about some diesel re-engineering options.
Right.
Primarily from you while we're talking about this article.
Or
this segment. But go ahead, let's hear about some of the more conventional options.
All right. So more conventional options in terms of straight, if you want to go diesel, General Dynamics has done a couple of prototypes on their own. General Dynamics has put an MTU 883 V12 1500 horsepower diesel in the back of the Abrams. It is the engine, basically very similar to the engine on the K2 Black Panther, which originally used 883s before the Koreans basically have their version put in it. It is smaller than the MTU 873 on a Leopard 2. So there's that difference.
It's a very regular naming system, isn't it?
Yeah. And don't get confused, folks. But so the 883, it does make 1,500 horsepower. It is smaller. It isn't the Euro Power Pack offered on the Export. Leclerc's also use the MTU 883. It does require a little bit of rear suspension reworking. Not insurmountable. It is a cost. But again, General Dynamics has done this. And if I was going to go diesel re-engineering, this would probably be my choice just because it's the closest to done. Also, General Dynamics license builds an MTU 883 clone for use in Israeli Merkavas. Hmm. The Merkava 4 uses General Dynamics license built 883s. So that's an option.
What's the power? What's the power on the current turbine?
The current turbine makes 1,500 horse.
Okay, well, it's nice to have it.
Well, 1,500 horse again. That's at the transmission. There's sprocket. Well, yeah, but
the apples to apples here.
Right. Yeah. Apples to apples. All the engines that I'm going to talk about tonight are 1,500 horsepower units. So option number two, the American AVDS 1790, which I believe I've written about here on the blog.
It sounds familiar.
It's a big air-cooled diesel. Again,
air cooling.
Straight air cooling, old school.
The Volkspanzer can't fucking.
Yep. The Israelis actually really like other older versions of this engine that don't quite make as much power, because air cooling is really rugged and really reliable and really, really easy to repair, and it resists damage quite well. It is a bulkier engine and requires somewhat more reworking. I've seen engineering drawings showing how this could be done, but nobody's, as far as I know, nobody's actually gone ahead and done it. It should be doable, again, with some reworking of the back compartment and the rear suspension.
So I guess it's not as much a drop-in as the German
not
options.
Not quite. Well, every diesel re-engineering of the Abrams requires you to remove the rearmost pair of torsion bars and replace them with some kind of external hydro-pneumatic suspension system. It doesn't be an adjustable one, but you have to get the suspension out because they need more height. And then it depends on how much reworking of that compartment you end up doing. You remember the gas turbine is small, but when you try to make it a little more fuel efficient by adding a recuperator to capture some of the heat you lose, that adds quite a bit of mass. Mm-hmm. So I guess the
problem then is that it's arranged differently, though.
Right. Yeah, you have a different set of blocky bits.
Similar volumes, but different arrangements thereof.
Yeah, the parts don't quite interchange, even though if you look at overall size of a Leopard 2 versus an Abrams power pack, and that's a bigger diesel, they're very similar sized. They're just shaped differently. One more diesel comes to mind, the MTU 893, which is the 1,500 horsepower V12 version of the engine installed on the Puma. That's even smaller than the 883. Again, 1,500 horsepower. It could be done. Nobody's done it yet, but that would be a possibility.
Is the next engine in that series the 8103?
I don't believe so. They haven't made any series beyond that. Mm. The 89X series is quite small. They're really neat little high power density diesels.
Hans, we're out of numbers. What are we going to do next?
Maybe use letters.
Nice. But the 893A is merely the follow-on to the 893. It is not correct.
Yep.
I guess that was kind of a Hans's, Alsatian cousin there.
Yep. Then, of course, the one gas turbine option that is new out there, sort of, is the LV100-5, which was originally proposed as part of the Crusader project. And the idea was that the Crusader and the Abrams would share an engine, namely the 100-5, which is a newer, more fuel-efficient gas turbine. Mm-hmm. With the cancellation of the Crusader, the LV100-5 is kind of still worn. It's nearly done, maybe 90-95% of the way there. It's an option. Again, it could be used. It's in mothballs.
It's got a funny but sad sort of thing. It's going to be this great engine coming up. I'm just going to cancel the whole project.
Right.
Suckers.
Well, the Crusader, Jay's going to get me to write on the Crusader because the Crusader was a really cool weapon system.
I do like artillery.
Yeah.
As befits my Russian heritage.
Right, and this is the fastest firing gun artillery around. It was designed for that.
The fastest gun in the West.
Yep. Yep. Take that, Russia. And then, of course, as the Army has done, they've tried to re-engine the Abrams a number of times in the past. In the late 80s, you had the CATTB project, which had a couple different engine proposals, including some almost non-adiabatic engines out there, but none of those have gone anywhere, and what the Army tends to do is decide, the existing gas turbine is good enough, and we'll just truck more fuel to the front and get over it.
Yeah.
Which is super boring, but that's what you could do.
It's a very big Army solution, though.
Yeah, it really is. We have an engine, it works, shut up and get over it.
We have an engine, it works. We also have a lot of trucks, and they work.
Yep. So let's talk about what their actual option is. Let's talk about their fine. But the Army has come to a decision, at least a program decision, which for what that's worth in Washington these days.
So what it means is it's going to get canceled.
I'm hoping. This idea is so monumentally stupid. The idea is to make a family of engines for all of the Army vehicles.
From the lowliest truck to the mightiest tank?
Yep. And they're going to make an engine family. And what's more, the engines will all be opposed piston engines. Now, for those of you not engine geeks out there, let me explain an opposed piston engine and how it differs from a flat engine. So if you think, you know, a V engine, we'll start with that because everyone knows what that is.
Yep.
There's a certain number of degrees between the two banks of cylinders, right? And, you know, something like a Harley Davidson is, 45, I think?
Beats me.
Whatever. But you have the number of degrees in between, right? And a wider V is more degrees, and 90 degrees is pretty common. If you imagine that V and you go to 180 degrees between these cylinders, then the pistons are basically both pointing out. The heads are opposite each other. They're pointing outwards from a central crankshaft. This is a flat engine.
Common in sports cars of various vintages and designs.
Yeah, the Volkswagens and the Porsches are all flat engines.
Yeah, I think the Subaru's got a couple too.
Yep. And now, if we invert that engine and put a pair of crankshafts on the outside, and then have the pistons pointing at each other, so the cylinder head is no more. It is, in fact, another piston. That is an opposed piston engine. If you're thinking this sounds really complicated, it is. We'll have a Wikipedia link just in case you need more pictures. And the opposed piston engine is another case of the Army going for something overambitious and technically complicated, like that stupid varial compression engine. And they've never worked in the past. So problem one is that the opposed piston engines have a long history of being liked by designers for being small. And they've never worked. So you have the British on the Chieftain tank had the Leland, yes, British Leland built L60 engine. It had a tendency to break a lot and catch fire. And mostly break.
Catching fire seems like a bad characteristic for tank engines.
Yes, yes. Fire is bad. Braking is bad. They never worked right. The the Kharkiv factory? He said abusing the pronunciation.
Kharkiv. Hard.
Yeah, well, those losers. They have an opposed piston engine as well, used in the T-64, and they have a variant of it in the T-80. It also has a long history of braking and catching fire. And attempts to start it on a cold day cause it to catch fire again. And it's not like Russia isn't a very cold place. No. So the Russians, of course, had a miserable time with the engines in the T-64. When the Russians were looking for a compact engine for the Armada, the T-14, they went with an X configuration. They did not rip off the engine that they were familiar with that was very small, the opposed piston 5TD and 6TD. Because they stink. They are steaming piles of garbage, and the British decided that the Leland engine was trash and underpowered and also broken trash. And if you look at the engine in the Challenger 1 and 2, it is in a normal V configuration like smart people.
It is kind of funny that the British ended up replacing an engine because it's underpowered, given that after the the heady days of World War II, it seems like they didn't really care about fast tanks anymore.
No, yeah. But like the Chieftain is underpowered even for them.
Oh, wow.
I mean, remember, these are people who have... So if you remember, the Abrams originally was, 54, 57 metric tons and had 1,500 horsepower. The Challenger 2 is originally 62 metric tons and has 1,200 horsepower.
My.
And they thought this was acceptable. So you can imagine how bad the engine must have been for even the British tankers to say, yeah, mate, we maybe need a little bit more power there. Just a little more power.
Yeah, the funny thing is the Chieftain was actually one of the impulses behind the design of the T-62.
Yeah.
That's something I've learned from my birthday present from John, a wonderful book on the history and development of the T-62 with tons and tons of wonderful pictures.
Yep. Well, the Chieftain is an interesting tank design, but its engine is terrible. And there's a lot of nice things to like about the Chieftain. The engine isn't one of them. The other big problem I have here, big set of problems I have here is the nature of this engine family. It sounds great on paper. I kicked around the idea a bit for some of my pencil and paper designs, some of my earlier ones. But boy, it would be great if I had a whole family of engines. Then I'd only need one set of spare parts and one set of training manuals and one set of training classes. And the idea lingered for a while when I was, you know, sketching my own designs, because I was designing basically everything from scratch. Thing is, Big Army isn't. There's a lot of vehicles that work just fine with the engines they have now, which are optimized for a specific use profile. So you're going to use a Humvee or a JLTV differently than you will use a Hemt tactical truck, you know, the big 10-ton jobbers that go anywhere. And that'll have a different engine use profile than a tank. And to design an engine family that's going to work across all the different power and torque curves, you're basically going to get a hybrid that's going to do nothing well.
Right.
And it'll break down a lot because opposed piston engines stink. That's like all they do is break.
It's kind of their lot in life.
It really is. And I know that someone is going to say in the comments, but we could maybe design it better. Yes, we could. Or we could start with an engine that works. If you were going to design a new engine, you could start with an engine design that doesn't have a long history of failure.
I think that the bigger issue for me is that the use cases are so different in terms required engine characteristics.
Right.
Like for a tank engine, you want something that's compact, but, you know, has nice big cylinders and a lot of engine displacement that can make a bunch of power. But you don't need that for, a little Humvee.
Right.
And if you're just using, like, say, two opposed cylinders then, like two opposed pistons, rather, like, you know, one cylinder.
Yeah.
Suddenly you've got all this extra complexity and mass and bulk. And it seems to me that it's not well served.
No.
Like designing one family of engines. I mean, you can maybe get by with two, one for like your big armored fighting vehicles and one family for your, large trucks and down.
Right.
Those are similar use cases. Like you're,
that might work.
Yeah, well, like from a Humvee up to the Hemt. That's roughly similar operating like parameters and characteristics and things you want the engine to do. And then from your, I don't know, maybe your Stryker up to your Abrams.
Similar-ish profiles, and that might work. Again, though, you know, you're not designing all these things in a vacuum. The all the Oshkosh vehicles have their own engines,
right? And they're all quite happy with them.
Yeah,
and I'm sure there's not going to be budget for, you go to Congress and say we'd like $50 million to re-engine all of our 5-ton trucks.
Yeah, and they're gonna laugh at you. And no,
like, do they not work now?
Well, and then
no sir, they do actually work. Well, denied.
Yeah, the other problem you have,
hearing over, see you later.
Yeah, we're gonna go play golf. The other problem you have is that the rest of the Army isn't gonna stand for this project either. I mean, let's look at a related example for something that's a much more pressing need, right? Like, as you mentioned, all of these trucks work great with the engines they have. And the Abrams even works pretty well with the engine it has. The U.S. Air Force needs tankers, but they never end up buying any tankers because whenever they get money, they spend on something cooler. Yeah. What's cooler than re-engineering a truck that works fine right now?
A new tank.
Everything.
Yeah.
New tank.
New IFV.
New IFV. New carbine. New sight. New tank gun.
New truck.
Sure. New truck. New missile system. Yeah. New drone. New anti-drone laser. You know, all these things are gonna steal money from it. So I really don't expect this to go anywhere. The Army has a terrible history with re-engineering projects. I don't know why, but they do. And this one is particularly foolhardy.
Even by Army standards.
Yeah. You know it's bad when I, the, like, advanced future technology fanboy, think it's terrible. But speaking of the future, and upwards, and Excelsior.
Nice. Good segue.
We're going to talk about rocket engines, Jay.
We are going to talk about rocket engines.
So, let's start with the basics. What kind of rocket are we talking about here?
So, we're talking about kind of the modern and most likely reusable rocket, kind of looking toward the future, I guess.
Right.
We're going to touch on some past designs and some things that we've done that have kind of led up to where we are now.
Right.
But basically the idea of this segment is we're going to talk about the engines that are in use and are going to be in use on your Falcons and then your Musk's BFRs.
Right.
You expand that acronym yourself in your head. And the new Glenn from Blue Origin, which is right. The one I'm rooting for, because I'm a hipster like that.
Yeah.
At any rate, so rocket engines. A rocket engine is basically just a big reaction engine. It takes a bunch of fuel of some sort of combustible, in some sort of combustible form, and mixes it all together and shoots it out the back, and on account of it shooting out the back, you go in the other direction. Simple. Very, like, Newtonian.
Yep. Rockets are cool.
Right. Of course, it's not actually all that simple in the long run. We're going to leave aside solid rockets altogether here because, well, although they are interesting in a number of ways, like the way you design the cavity in the middle determines like the burn profile.
Because you can store them ready for launch at unsuspecting Russians.
Yes, it's true. It's true that a liquid fueled rocket is not as suitable for use as say a ballistic missile, for instance.
Right. But yeah.
Just to pull it like to pluck an example out of nowhere.
This is just some use case. In particular, we're cherry picking.
Right. But the things you can do with liquid fueled rockets make them great for civilian and like non-immediate military use cases. So,
like what, Jay?
Well, you can reuse a liquid rocket. I suppose you can also reuse a solid rocket. But the only time we've done that with the space shuttle, it proved to be cheaper just to build new ones.
Right.
Yeah.
It's kind of cost prohibitive because he has to rebuild that stupid liner bit.
Like that whole propellant liner, basically, because
yeah.
It's complicated. You can throttle a liquid rocket, and that's important if you're trying to land the boosters, because it may surprise you to find that an empty rocket is much lighter than a full rocket.
What? Yeah. No, that's crazy talk.
And when you're trying to land it, if you turn one engine on and suddenly you're on your way back to orbit, that's not good.
No, land and orbit are in different places.
So all the modern engines, the ones on the Falcon rockets and the ones on the proposed Blue Origin rockets, those are all very deeply throttleable. So you can cut the thrust down to a bare minimum. They're also restartable, which is handy. You know, it's no use trying to land a rocket if you can't restart the engines.
Right. It's another thing you really don't get. There are ways of workarounds, but that's another thing you really don't get with a solid rocket motor.
Yeah. So that's kind of the justification there for your thingies.
Right. So if I'm going to use a liquid-fueled rocket, and I guess you've talked me into it for everything other than, you know, shooting nukes at commies, what kind of gas am I going to put in this stupid thing?
Well, so actually, let's talk about what you need to do with the fuel first.
Sure thing.
So the thing about rockets is the exhaust is very hot.
What?
Yeah.
No.
I'm blowing everyone's mind here with this
knowledge
segment so
bombs.
Far. Yeah. And in fact, it's so hot that that your standard, there's not really material that can withstand the temperature of rocket exhaust besides like tungsten and graphite. And those are kind of cost prohibitive for rocket nozzles.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to cool down the nozzle somehow. And the modern way seems to be the case that basically all modern rockets use a regenerative cooling cycle. So you're at least one of your fuel or your oxidizer is going to be some gas stored as a liquid at like cryogenic temperatures. And so you run that through the nozzle to take, to serve as like a coolant. And then that runs further into the rocket. You need to move fuel around. This usually takes the form of pumps. We'll cover more of that later. And of course you need to burn it all.
Right.
And, there's a lot of interesting design of injectors and nozzle shapes and things that I'm not going to touch on very much because I think that's kind of outside of scope.
Right.
Mostly we're talking just about the propulsion here. So you were asking about gas.
Yeah, and I'm also going to say, well, gee, why do I need this stupid cryo crap? Isn't there some alternative to, frozen nonsense?
Do you remember that old Messerschmitt 163, John?
Do I ever?
Yeah.
The exploding comet.
Yep. Well, that's kind of the problem you have with fuels that aren't stored at very cold temperatures. So if you have a couple of options. You can store all of our fuels cold, like with methane and oxygen or hydrogen and oxygen fuel cycles.
Right.
You can store some of them cold, like liquid oxygen and kerosene or RP1, which are fairly common today.
Yep.
Or you can store them both warm. And the ones that you store warm are like literally the most terrible substances on the planet.
Yeah, some kind of.
It's good that you're trying to launch them off the planet. That's a net win, but you've still got to get them to the launch pad and then into the rocket somehow without making everything blow up. And that turns out to be really, really hard.
Oh, like that stuff in the Blackbird used to light its engines, boring.
Again. Oh, actually, I know that. I used that in a science fiction thing, like aliens who expelled it, like who breathed it out, and that was a kind of a plot point. When the first human explorers met them, their suits vented oxygen into the atmosphere and then exploded. So
nice.
It's kind of a...
That'd be bad. Hydrazine tetroxide, I recall, is also nasty.
Yeah. Really, they're all nasty. Any room temperature rocket fuel is just by its nature going to be some terrible substance that's trying to explode or kill you or both all at the same time.
Oh boy, my favorite things. I know what's going on my Christmas wish list.
Yeah. Monopropellant rocket. I mean, when you get to monopropellant, it's even worse because then you just like expose them to some catalyst and suddenly kaboom.
Oh, darn.
Like not even any mixing. Anyway, so because of all that, you t- tend to have either semi-cryogenic or fully cryogenic fuels in modern rockets.
Right. You mentioned a lot of common ones, liquid oxygen, kerosene, and hydrogen.
The classic choice is that liquid oxygen kerosene, or like liquid oxygen RP-1 thing.
Right.
And I believe that's what's currently in use on the SpaceX Falcon rockets. It's a lot of Russian first stages, a lot of American first stages.
Yeah.
All of these things.
Saturn V was Kero and liquid ox.
Yep. I think it was for the first stage. I think the
second stage and third were hydrogen and liquid oxygen.
And so that kind of brings us to where we are now. Both the engine designs for the next generation of civilian rockets, the Blue Origin BE-4 and the SpaceX Raptor, they use a methane and oxygen fuel cycle for a couple of reasons. One, liquid methane's easy to store relative to liquid hydrogen. Liquid hydrogen is a pain to store. It's got to be kept super cold compared to just like the really, really cold you need for liquid oxygen and liquid
methane.
Really
cold versus super cold.
More importantly, methane's pretty easily synthesizable out in the solar system. And for these two rocket companies whose long-range plans involve sending them to other places and having them, fill up there, being able to make the fuel on-site is a big win.
You mean there isn't just an Exxon or a Sheetz over on Mars?
You know, there isn't. You actually have to bring your own dinosaurs to Mars, even. So.
Aw, man.
At any rate.
Stupid Sheetz. Mars gas station.
So yeah, Methalox is kind of the way of the future. That's the direction everyone's going. Hydrolox kind of had its day because it is a more efficient fuel cycle than Methalox, and it fixes a couple of problems. Methane, if you're doing it wrong, can cause coking on your turbopumps, which is bad for reuse. But in general, if you do it right, it's the best modern, well, maybe not the best, but the most reusable, most well understood modern fuel cycle.
Fair enough.
And that brings us on to how to make the rocket work.
All right. So I've got to get this stupid cold fuel crap into the combustion chamber where we can make it go burn.
Exactly. So there are a couple of ways to do this. You can pressurize your tanks.
All right. Cue Billy Joel.
It's kind of annoying to do that, though, because then you've got to make your tanks really big and heavy. And one of the advantages to liquid-fueled rockets is you get a pretty good, mass fraction going. Because, supposing you have an unpressurized tank, liquid's, pretty dense, just by its nature. Denser, I think, than a lot of solid rocket fuels, but I don't know that offhand, so don't trust me on that. Look it up yourself. Or maybe I will and put it in the description. At any rate, pressurized tanks are okay if you're building like a small rocket. They're also very reliable and easy to start up again because you just open the valve and suddenly you've got fuel and oxidizer.
Pressure.
So you find pressurized rockets for satellite orbital control systems and things.
Right. Very simple, very robust, easy to tinker with.
Stepping up a little bit, you can have unpressurized fuel tanks and pumps of some kind to pressurize your fuel and get it into the combustion chamber at the rate, at the incredible rate that it needs to be to burn. So you can do electric pumps. That's a very simple system. Batteries are, however, heavy, and you need a big motor to run those pumps too. And that's not ideal, especially considering you've got all this fuel right there you can do something with.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of solutions to that. The one currently in use on the Falcon rockets is the gas generator cycle. So you tap off a little bit of your fuel and a little bit of your oxidizer and use that to spin a turbopump. That turbopump moves the largest amount of fuel down to the combustion chamber, and then suddenly you get a rocket. The stuff from the gas generator just kind of goes out the side or down out the bottom of the nozzle, not really contributing to thrust. So you lose some efficiency there because you are using some of your fuel to spin pumps as opposed to make your rocket go. And that's not ideal.
Right, we want to avoid that.
There are a couple of other things along those same lines that use excess fuel in some way to spin pumps. There's one that you can tap the exhaust from the nozzle, but that's kind of hard to get going or to get restarted. Exhaust products, say.
Right.
And you can use some of the fuel heated by its, path to cool the nozzle to spin pumps too, but then again you lose fuel doing that. So the cycle of the future appears to be what they call staged combustion. Staged combustion is when you use some of your fuel and oxidizer to spin the pump, but you don't combust it fully. So you have a fuel-rich mix that goes into the turbopump. Enough oxidizer is added to combust it, and then you've got fuel-rich gas coming out the far side. So you're spinning the turbo pump with a fuel-rich gas. That fuel-rich gas then goes into the combustion chamber and is ignited along with the rest of the oxidizer. So you're using all of your fuel.
Okay.
That's good. That gives you better efficiency. You're not throwing anything overboard, which is bad because rockets are hard and nobody likes wasting gas. A couple of options on how you do it. You can do it like Blue Origin is doing, or is aiming to do now, with just the one turbopump. Or you can do it like with the so-called full-flow staged combustion engine, like SpaceX wants to do with their upcoming Raptor engine. Now, what that does is it has two turbopumps, one with a fuel-rich mix and one with an oxidizer-rich mix. So all the fuel is going to power turbopumps to pull more fuel in. Like, all the fuel and oxidizer is going to those turbopumps to pull more of their respective substances in, and then the fuel-rich gas and the oxidizer-rich gas meet in the combustion chamber, and everything goes swimmingly. That's better because it takes fewer seals, I think. There's some efficiency gains to be had, some reliability gains to be had there at the cost of more mechanical complexity. Right. Turbo pumps are hard, and having two of them is harder than having one of them.
Right. And for more details on what can go wrong with turbo pumps, look up the N1 rocket, kids.
Yeah, that's a very good example. It's kind of funny we've gone back in that direction with rocket designs, though.
Yeah.
I think what's happened is we've gotten much better at isolating the individual engine things, like the individual engine units from one another.
Right.
So the N1's problem was it had kind of cascading failures going on.
Yeah, it was a pretty awesome cascade when 29 of your 30 engines shut off because of, you know, turbopump problems.
Whereas a couple of SpaceX launches have actually had one engine unit fail out of the 9 on a Falcon.
Right.
And they've still continued to orbit just without reusing the stage, because you can run the other engines hotter or longer and still make it to your target orbit, although you may have to sacrifice the booster to do so.
Right.
And that about covers the modern rocketry experience. Again, I'm not really an expert on this. If you want a real expert, go watch like Scott Manley videos on YouTube.
Yep. He's just an apprentice rocket expert.
Exactly, yeah. I just, you know, read up on this so I could do this segment and sound like I know what I'm talking about. But really, is that not the true purpose of journalism, to comment on things we're not actually qualified to comment on?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're at least, you know, we have way more integrity than the rest of those losers.
So yeah, any further rocket questions?
No, I think that about covers it.
Yeah, I was fairly thorough.
Other than, you know, maybe when can I have my warp drives up from Cochrane?
Yeah, well, you got to talk to the M-Drive guy about that.
Right, yeah, that cool thing. But that's a topic for another time.
So we've talked about two kinds of engines. We've talked about tank engines and rocket engines. We're going to talk a little bit about game engines, or more precisely, games. Games that were sadly unloved in their time, that died early deaths, and that we think should have done better. So yep. I'll leave John to do the first one.
All right. So this goes back a bit, but that's okay. Some time ago, you may recall a game called Supreme Commander. And this came out when Jay and I were in college. And I think surely before we were in college. Whatever. Yeah. We played a lot in college. And Supreme Commander is probably the last and greatest of the base builder real-time strategy games. Things like your Command & Conquer and your StarCraft. Though StarCraft's still around, but I'll comment on that in a second. And Supreme Commander was great because you could build really big armies. And you could zoom in or out as much as you wanted. And your economy was rate-based, so you could get just giant coffers full of money and spend them on armies of robots. You know, just giant armies that
NATO counters when you zoomed out. You got, like, little things to symbolize what your units did.
Yeah. Oh, it was great. And you could get an army that would make Falkenhayn jealous. And you would send this army against another army of robots in these epic World War I, like, terrifying battles that would leave blackened husks of robots everywhere. And eventually you'd clobber the other guy into submission. And it was great fun.
I think one of my favorite Supreme Commander things was the fire base, where you plop down a shield generator and some artillery pieces and some defense turrets.
Yep.
And suddenly you have this power projection, you know, little base you can leapfrog across the map and do what you want with.
Yeah. And if you were playing the blue dudes, there was also the super weapon. And the super weapons in Supreme Commander were actually super. Like, if a nuke got through, you had a bad day. And I really liked that. I have fond memories as a little kid playing StarCraft and triggering a nuke strike and being all, that's it.
Well, that's it. Yeah.
Come on, man. But so that's not really a nuke. These were actual nukes that scared you, but then you built missile defenses, and everyone had cool super weapons, giant super guns, like Gerald Bull would get all kinds of crazy four and
enormous walking spiders,
all the spider bots, and that giant UFO thing from Independence Day that flies over the White House
with the giant laser beam.
Exactly. And it could, you know, launch. It was just like the UFO from Independence Day. Yeah. It was even a flying aircraft carrier.
That's true.
You know, a submersible aircraft carrier.
Big land battleship.
Giant mecha. Oh, it was great.
Also underwater battleship, I guess, wasn't it? It could drive underwater.
Yeah. No, there were all manner
amphibious of... Amphibious land battleship.
Amphibious land battleship. That's like, take that, H.G. Wells. We're going to outdo you.
Exactly.
And then it had a sequel, and the sequel didn't get much press.
Because they kind of killed everyone that was good about it.
Yep. All the big armies were gone.
Supreme Commander 1 was it was almost unique, I think, in the world of strategy games. It was a big, large-scale RTS that had the information control features you needed to actually make that work.
Yep. I actually felt like a general for once.
And Supreme Commander 2, or at least a colonel. Supreme Commander 2 was a lot smaller, a lot tighter in focus, more like a traditional RTS. And I think
That kind of killed it, because, at that time you still had some other base builders, but that entire genre is gone now. Like, the whole base building genre is just gone.
I think you were going to mention StarCraft 2, but that's also, like, 7 or 8 years old now, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah, so I don't think that counts anymore, because they haven't... I mean, they've released expansions and a few new units, but it's still the same thing.
I think the strategy genre is more or less dead right now, isn't it?
I would agree. I would agree, and I would... StarCraft is a different kind of strategy. The thing about StarCraft is it always feels to me like the early stages of a chess game where I've memorized an opening and you've memorized an opening and we're going to play through our parts and whoever can execute the opening better and in StarCraft's case faster is going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And Supreme Commander was slow enough and stately enough that you could react and actually think in real during the game.
Right. I mean, your click rate was important, but not the end all. You could get away with being like playing as a thinking man's game.
Right. I also have fond memories playing against the computer of, you know, doing like some homework and then looking up and queuing up a whole bunch of units or managing an attack and then going back to homework and, you know, oh, yep, all right, I need to shore up my defenses here. And then you go right back doing homework. It was just a great thing in college to pass the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, the base building strategy game is gone. I think for a while the other kinds of strategy games where you had less thinking and more action kind of eclipsed it. But once you go down that slope, you know, we're going to go right into that slippery slope argument fallacy.
Oh, it's not a fallacy. Some slopes are slippery.
Exactly. Yeah. And in this case, what you get is, if I'm going to play something like Company Heroes, which is still a great game, where I'm going to get away with rid of some of the thinking, why don't I just play Call of Duty? And get straight to shooting someone.
To go in the direction, play a MOBA, say.
Right. MOBA.
If you're not playing, it may as well go like to Dota or League of Legends or something.
Yep, exactly. And personally, I can't stand those games, but I think I'm like one of two people on the planet who, you know, can't stand those games.
Yeah. I have heard good things about a recent strategy game, Tooth and Tail, actually.
But, yeah.
I haven't played it yet, so I can't really comment on whether it's any good or not.
The one thing I will say is that somebody did, someone who is probably going to get a thank you letter from me for Christmas, did remake a number of the early Command & Conquer titles in the Tiberian Sun engine, which is the, like, say, vintage 98-2000 era Command & Conquer game.
Mm.
So for a lot of the, you know, the really early mid-90s ones, this, while it's still an old engine, it's runnable on modern systems without a lot of trouble, and it is a big engine upgrade. So if you're interested in that, Dawn of the Tiberian Age is your Google cue. And again, and it's, they did, it looks much better. Again, it's a 2000 game, but it looks decent and much better than the old ones. You know, if you were going to fire up original Red Alert or original Command and Conquer, you know, no colons, no subtitle.
Yeah.
So it's a big improvement there. And it's old school hard.
Yeah, classic.
Awesome. Yeah, that warmed my heart. How about you, Jay? So I'm sitting over here weeping about my lost strategy mecha. And my no more trench system. What are you sad about?
Well, I'm sad about something that unfortunately almost really never was. So let's talk about Guns of Icarus. Now, if you're like me, you've heard of this. But if you're like John, you probably haven't. I mean, because it was sort of a flash in the pan some time ago. But let me set the scene for you.
Oh, wait, Icarus, isn't that the guy with the wax?
Yeah, flew close to the sun, melted, death, fell down.
Yeah, it was
very sad.
Yeah, and I want to be like him. No.
Well, no. At any rate, so Guns of Icarus, it is a multiplayer airship combat game. Picture this. You're standing on the wooden deck of a steampunk airship styled like a pirate ship with broadside guns and everything.
Okay.
Big balloon over your head. you can be a captain, a gunner, an engineer. You're running around this thing, fixing it, navigating, shooting at the enemy airships. It's really it's a wonderful co-op experience. It's a kind of a classic. It's something that, as a writer of airship-related fiction, I am drawn to this sort of thing. But I think anyone with an appreciation for that sort of steampunk or, you know, kind of clockwork punk, old-timey Victorian.
I'm feeling something very Wild Wild West. If you remember
exactly.
That,
that's it's a very similar feel to that. Yeah,
yeah.
So you got like this Wild Wild West post-apocalyptic airship co-op combat game that was never very big. And do you know why that is?
Well, I can think of a couple reasons.
Well, they started it as a PvP game, so it is your co-op airship against another team of against another co-op airship, say, or your team against another team, and that's kind of a downer, I think. You're playing this game with so many opportunities for cooperation, and then that other team, who's been practicing for 3 years, just completely wipes the floor with you.
Right. Yeah. Well, or even, you know, it doesn't have to be that much more practice, but you know, you just straight up, like, if you have any experience at all, you listeners with MMOs, you know the torture that is a raid, where if you can get your buddies where you're all on the same channel in Discord or whatever,
yeah,
that raid is going to go a lot better than you and like 3 or 8 or however many other random losers who, you know, are huffing paint and don't know which button to click.
Yeah. And so the problem is it started off with too little content. It started off as a PvP game.
Right. And you're just always going to get ganked by better teams, especially if you don't have a good way of like of figuring out who are the like serious teams that are communicated.
Right. Who's going to pub stomp the crap out of you and who's going to be a roughly fair fight.
Exactly.
Anyway, so they did solve that problem eventually. There are two Guns of Icarus products on Steam. There's Guns of Icarus Online, which is the PvP thing. And there's Guns of Icarus Alliance, which is the PvP thing. And then also a co-op mode with like a big, like, a meta game and like a big world map you can move around on and everything. And that, again, I think that's another thing that they kind of, that, well, another thing that's a big draw to me, that kind of, that big, that feeling of a larger universe, even if it's in a game where you're not really doing anything very different on a moment-to-moment basis.
Right. And as we all know, PvE is a lot less stressful, and it's where all the babies go.
Well, yes, but it's where you get your start. You know, you learn what you're doing in the PvE section. And then if you feel like it, you can dip your toes into the PvP stuff without being a complete noob that's wrecking the experience for everyone else on your team.
Right.
Which always makes you feel a little bad, right?
Like, yeah, you don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, we lost completely because of me and I feel terrible.
But the other thing, too, is that if, you know, your group can't meet for a night to, you know, do the match that you wanted, you could try to fill holes with random losers and have a terrible time because they're all going to be idiots. Or you could try the PvE and kill some time and, you know, beat up the computer.
Well, the random losers who are going to be idiots aren't really a big handicap because, you know, you can change the difficulty. You can play around with how you want to approach the fight.
Right. PvE is just generally less hard.
Anyway, so
more forgiving.
As a game, I think it works really well. You have the experience as the captain of, you know, learning to helm this massive ship and direct your crew. It's got a good set of voice macros if you don't have a microphone, if you don't want other, you know, random strangers to hear your voice.
Some people have serious voice fears.
Well, voice fears or just like, I don't know you people, why don't I want to talk to you?
This is true.
Yeah, and I feel like John identifies with that one very strongly.
Yep.
So you like the, and then as the, as the gunners and engineers, there's always a lot to do. You've got to move around the ship and make sure that it doesn't fall out of the sky. You've got to be ready to like to listen to the captain's directions, to switch sides of the guns. The thing about the game is that there are too few people to do everything you need to do on the airship all at once. So it's a kind of a game of managing your own time and knowing what your team is doing so that you can fill in with what they're not able to do at the moment. It's an excellent gameplay loop. It's very rewarding, like when it's done well, and even when it's done poorly, because there's kind of that skin of the teeth escape sort of thing.
Right.
And you know, although it's mostly dead, it's not quite entirely dead. You can still find people to play with, in both the co-op and the PvP side. Although there are only maybe like 100 people on a given night.
Right. Well, but that's like Supcom. If you know,
I
make,
exactly.
Yeah. You know, give me 5 minutes, to make a couple calls, I'll get a match for going. But you know.
Yeah. So like you can still find ways to play, and I think if you can find it on like a deep Steam sale, it's maybe worth a flyer.
Right.
I don't know. I don't think I can recommend it as much as it pains me. At full price, but if you can get it for like $5, you'll probably get $5 worth of fun learning how to fly this random steampunky Wild Wild West airship around and
right.
finding some random people to man the guns or manning some random person's guns and taking down the, you know, absurdly vulnerable AI, because that's just, it's just a much better game that way. Yep. And it's kind of sad that came second.
Indeed. And actually, let me just go back a second to bring up two things. Get a good point. The Steam recommendation, I would recommend Supreme Commander for any reasonable price you can find it these yes. days, because it'd probably be super cheap. And if you like that kind of strategy game, you'll like this. I'll also point out that Dawn of the Tiberian Age is not only free, but it's also completely standalone. So if you've lost or never owned a copy of Tiberian Sun, you can still play ridiculously hard old school strategy games and die a lot because the computer is miserable.
And that brings us more or less to the end of this show. We're not actually all that sorry we didn't get one out in October. We didn't have much to talk about, and the month off did us a lot of good. So
right, we got a good episode in this time.
If you were disappointed, we're sorry. If you were angry, well, screw you.
I see I'm rubbing off on my co-host.
That about wraps things up. In kind of a little end of episode bit of news, the DCS Harrier comes out. You can tomorrow at time of recording, or possibly today, whenever it comes out on Wednesday the 28th, whenever I actually post this episode, I'll right. put it that way. You can expect some content about that from me, and some content from both of us when DCS releases its 2.5 version, right. which they've said is coming in a couple of weeks, but neither of us actually believe that.
Nope.
But yeah, that's coming sometime in the not too distant future.
And, we hope.
Well, at least that's true. I'd like to think it's going to come sometime in the not too distant future.
Right.
Anyway, the Crossbox podcast is produced by my co-host John and me, Jay, and is brought to you by Many Words Press, online at manywords.press. Our theme music is Royal Rumble by Jay Mann of ourmusicbox.com and is used under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution License. You can keep up with us, the Crossbox contributors, between podcasts at soapbox.manywords.press.
Good night, everybody.